Welcome to Muffliato, a Harry Potter podcast where we fill your ears to prevent you from hearing nearby conversations. I'm Josh.
And I'm Blake, and today we put on a pot of tea as we continue our journey through Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban and come now to the sixth chapter, Talons and Tea Leaves. Now, last week with our last episode, Josh didn't really talk much about it having been the Christmas, and now we're kind of past the Christmas sort of, well, we're still here in New Zealand in the summer season. How have you been enjoying being over in Canada? It's good to be back in the saddle of, I think, the original episodes, you know, like bonus episodes are fun, but I do love going through these books.
Yeah, no, I'm really looking forward to getting back into it, Blake. It's been a great Christmas time here. We've had snowstorms, ice storms, looking like we're going to have a rainstorm today. So it has been quite the weather we've had, but a lovely time over here.
One of the other things I needed to ask is that, did you end up being able to watch the 20th anniversary special for Harry Potter?
I have not been able to, Blake.
I'm
saddened by that fact. Yes, have not been able to make that. So hopefully the plan is to watch it. I think my sister is potentially coming back for a visit sometime and hopefully watch it then. So we'll need to do a bit of a chat about it sometime. Maybe I can ask her if I can watch it ahead of time for podcast purposes, but we'll see.
Yes. Yeah. We'll see if she allows that. But I didn't know if you could watch it on like New Zealand's kind of like TV and set on demand. Cause I did see it was, you know, there after they played it in New Zealand.
Was it on demand?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It was awesome. Yeah. Really enjoyed it. It was on, I think, the 2nd of January here in New Zealand. And had a lot of fun watching that, you know, and it was just obviously a few faces there that were missing, which was a bit sort of sad, you know. You want everybody to be there, like, and all the characters and stuff like that. But they got a lot of the main ones, which was fun, and there was some good memories shared, and so it was a good kind of look back, you know. It was very, very touching and heartfelt in moments. Oh, but since you haven't seen it, I don't want to reveal too much. Maybe later on we'll give, out of all the, you know, Harry Potter podcasts, we'll give like the most super belated talking about the 20th anniversary once you've seen it. But I know all the other Harry Potter fans out there are going, oh, you haven't found a way to watch it, Josh. Oh no. But it's okay. How about we jump into our chapter summary of this sixth chapter in Prisoner of Azkaban?
Like, this is the second longest chapter in the book. It's quite a long one. And the summary is likewise a bit long as well, just because so much happens. There's so many different scenes that happen in this chapter.
It's almost like two chapters.
It really is. I think there could have been a bit of a division that could have taken place maybe after lunch and before lunch, care of magical creatures outside. But anyway, I'll get to it. Apologies if it is too long, but like I said, one of the longest chapters in the book. The third-year Hogwarts students finally begin their new classes. Hermione's timetable looks particularly interesting, as Ron notices that she is scheduled to take three classes at once. Brushing this aside, Hermione assures him that Professor McGonagall has sorted everything. The journey to the divination classroom is as long as it is difficult for Harry and Ron. Once Sybil Trelawney welcomes the students, they immediately notice the differences between this room and any other at Hogwarts. Trelawney, eager to impress a new cohort of students, makes several predictions concerning the coming year, the climax of which is her vision of the Grim in Harry's teacup. Most of the students are amazed at her abilities and shaken by Harry's upcoming demise. Only Hermione remains resolute in her suspicions of divination, something that is confirmed by McGonagall's dismissal of Sybil Trelawney's predictions. However, at lunch, Harry confides to Ron that this is not the first time that he has seen the Grim. Hermione contrasts the quality of her arithmancy class with that of her divination lesson, but for Ron and Harry, their biggest response is to wonder how she has already taken both classes. Outside for care of magical creatures, Hagrid is amazed that none of the students figured out how to tame their monstrous books. This rough start gives way to a mesmerizing introduction to hippogriffs, magical animals with the hindquarters of a horse and the wings, talons, and head of a bird. Harry is selected to be the first to approach Buckbeak, and after some pause by the creature, he is able to fly on his back around the grounds. The students are all impressed, save for the Slytherin. Harry's skill causes Malfoy to lose all respect for the animal and to ignore Hagrid's instructions about the respect needed to approach hippogriffs. He insults Buckbeak and receives a talon swipe to the arm. Malfoy is rushed to the hospital wing while he cries for the whole castle to hear him. That evening, Hagrid is sure that he will be sacked and drowns his sorrows in his bucket-sized mug. The trio assure him that he will not be fired and that they will be his witnesses to Malfoy's behavior. Once he is calmed, he realizes that Harry is outside the castle after dark and quickly brings them back, not before scolding them for their foolishness.
Man, how much do you just, you hate on Malfoy for his behavior here, you know, and how he acts. Like, you just think it's so, like, savage that this is, like, Hagrid's first lesson, but there is just, like, no respect from, you know, well, I shouldn't say all the Slytherins for Hagrid, but at least, you know, pretty close that there's just no respect for him as a member of staff, you know, before he was a teacher, and then now that he's a teacher, and so it's kind of, they're just making a joke about it, but, like, I mean, I think Hagrid did a great job here at a first lesson. Yeah. Like, you know, it's the wizarding world, right? Like, I know later on they say, like, oh, you know, too advanced. The creature was too advanced for the students or something like that. But I'm like, I mean, it's the wizarding world, you know? There's like, there's going to be those creatures no matter, like, you know, this is going to be dangerous no matter if Malfoy's in his senior year, you know, like.
Maybe what he could have done is brought down Madame Pomfrey for a little, like, on-site first aid potential. I don't know.
That could have been
like,
good.
You know how they have, like, ambulances on site at football games, yes, and rugby games? Maybe they could have Trelawney on site for some of the Care of Magical Creatures left.
Yeah. So, did you say Trelawney? Because
nobody wants her there. Yeah, no. Madame Pomfrey.
Trelawney's like, Malfoy, if you be an annoying git, you will probably get slashed. You know, like, it's like,
but it's so interesting that you know, that Malfoy's own prejudices are exactly the reason for his demise. Right? He thinks to himself, there's nothing that Harry can do well that I can't, and so I'm not going to think that I actually need to follow his example of, you know, approaching respectfully. And there's no one I respect less than Hagrid because he's not a full human, right? He's half giant. Yeah. And so there's nothing that he could teach me. And so he dismisses Hagrid's instructions, he dismisses Harry's skill, and winds up with a massive slash through his arm.
Yeah, and it goes to show that I feel like any practical subjects in school, when there is some kind of experiment or, you know, physical thing, like an animal there, you really do need to listen to the instructions. You know, I feel like that's just so important. Like, it's like, hey, if there's a describing how to do some kind of math problem or English thing and you don't listen, there's not a physical danger coming to you unless
the stakes are pretty low.
Yeah, the stakes are pretty low. Whereas, you know, here the stakes are pretty high when it's coming down to this, you know, as I say, a very proud creature. You know, you want to make sure that you are listening. And Rowling does it, like, explicitly kind of mentions that they weren't listening because they were kind of talking up ways to probably get, you know, Hagrid, you know, sacked or maybe not sacked, but, like, make his lesson go poorly. So, yeah, I just feel like, man, it's a bit crazy how,
I feel crazy. Like, we could potentially start a bit of a counter on the number of times that Hagrid thinks he's going to get sacked, because I feel like that's a bit of a recurring theme in the books, is Hagrid thinks he's going to get fired.
Yeah, there's not a lot of confidence there. He doesn't have a whole lot of confidence, and I think that probably just stems from how he's probably been treated before, you know, not actually confident in his abilities, as, you know, being expelled. I think that probably comes into it. You know, there's a lot of these things where he's just thinking, I don't deserve this. You know, I don't know why. I mean, it's sort of something I've always wanted, but I don't know why Dumbledore entrusted this with me. You know, like, that's really cool, because Dumbledore approached him about it. You know, it's not like he's been working towards this and being like, I can't wait to do this, you know, and in 10 years I'll be a teacher or something. Like, it's like he's just happy with where he is, and it's Dumbledore who kind of approached him about the job. I mean, and thinking, you know, maybe moving into key theme, Josh, with put down here fortune and failure. I had to do it with talons and tea leaves, right?
I was going to say this is your favorite chapter title, isn't it, Blake?
yeah, it is. I just love a good good bit of alliteration. But talons and tea leaves just rolls off the tongue. It's just nice, yeah. So our key theme is fortune and failure, and there's both. You know, obviously we look at the fortune in the wizarding world of you know, fortune telling. telling and these sort of kind of surface level fortune telling kind of gimmicky things that, you know, obviously we have, you know, in the real world, there are those kind of like crystal ball gazing things and, you know, quite hoaxy things. But like in this wizarding world, there are, as I think McGonagall points out, there are sort of true seers, right? Like there's these people who have kind of this magical gift, whereas, you know, we're not too sure if she actually has it. But we have discussed in the past, and she being Professor Trelawney, but we have discussed in the past that a lot of her predictions actually come out right, like come out true. They're just not like, I don't know, they don't have high, they're not sort of a big consequence type of thing, except the Harry's death part. But I mean, did she say that Harry will die this year? I mean, you know, he did die, right? Like I don't know. The predictions just maybe aren't as good as a well-known true seer. So I think that's a thing running throughout this whole book is that sort of theme of fortune because they're clearly thinking about it and it's on their minds. And obviously Hermione's not too happy with it, but failure as well, because, you know, we clearly see Hermione, you know, she's failing to even kind of invest in the class because she thinks it's ridiculous, and then obviously the failure of Hagrid in his first lesson. So we see that both those things.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think too that, you know, as we look at this chapter, one of the neat things for us is to really see some of the ways that the subjects interplay with one another at Hogwarts. You know, it's no secret how some of the teachers feel about divination, looking at you, McGonagall, and to a lesser degree, Trelawney. And you kind of get that sense too of maybe not quite to the same degree, but you also do feel that, okay, Dumbledore was willing to put Hagrid in charge of care of magical creatures. Would he have done that for a subject like Transfiguration? Probably not. If there was like this really good self-trained Transfiguration teacher, probably not going to put him or her in charge of Transfiguration, like a premier subject. And so you kind of get this feeling that there is an interesting relationship between some of the subjects at Hogwarts. Hermione even comparing how much better one kind of elective is than another. So kind of an interesting insight that we don't
see. I think charms is probably more important than Muggle studies. I don't know, but I'm pretty sure Muggle studies probably isn't as important of a class as charms or potions.
Like you're like three quarters of the way to being a Death Eater with that attitude. Charity Burbage would not be impressed.
I know. She'd be like, clearly everybody hates Muggle studies. It's like, well, I mean, it's a wizarding world. Like, you know, you're really taking Muggle studies to like for one small area of jobs in the wizarding world.
Yeah. I feel like maybe Muggle studies could be like a great summer intensive. Like you come to Hogwarts for 1 week in the summer and have lectures on Muggle studies, because I do feel like the whole fact of its completely non-magical components in the Hogwarts castle kind of is a waste of your time while you're there, you know, like maybe we could do that. I know, and again, as a history teacher, maybe there's room for that with history of magic. Like maybe that would increase some enjoyment, is if the students who were taking that could come and then save all their, because in theory, Blake, you're not able to do magic outside of Hogwarts when you're a student. Now we all know that that's bent by certain students and families, like that rule is bent, but at the same time you do feel like if I'm getting my magical education, I want to be doing as much magic as possible. There's no law against learning about Muggles during the summer. Maybe I could learn about Muggles then. I don't know.
Yeah, I just feel like you know, Muggle studies should kind of be in with another subject, you know, to make it sort of, you know, it probably is a handy thing to realize this, you know, because it's a whole nother world, right? Like it's a very prominent world because you're actually living in secret.
Well, and we know from the book by way of example just how bad most wizards are at interacting with the Muggle world.
Yes, you know, or like, dressing and stuff.
Yeah, and so it's clearly needed. But it does seem to take up this huge chunk of the timetable when this is literally the only place these students are able to do magic. And so you think, you know, could maybe there be some, I don't know, adult education classes offered in Hogsmeade for all the all of the wizards and witches who are still so unable to do this. Like, there's got to
Yeah,
be
it's
something.
maybe there's like that's like what that's a crime, or like a low level crime. You know how it's like rehabilitation, go pick up rubbish on the freeway or something. Like maybe that's like you must attend a 1 week course on how to fit in with being a Muggle or something
Yeah,
like
like
that. You know, if for these people.
why doesn't Barty Crouch, I assume he's a very busy man, but why doesn't Barty Crouch do like a how to dress like a Muggle seminar at the Ministry for Magic?
Yeah,
Like there's
he
got to be
seems to have
something.
it down. It's so good though, because yeah, I feel like the only people taking Muggle studies, surely people who are doing the timetables and stuff, it'd be like, Harry, why are you taking Muggle studies? Clearly you're just trying to get an easy subject in that you know a lot about, and it's
Boost your
only
GPA.
Hermione. Yeah, exactly. It's only Hermione that's like, no, I see you're like, you actually want to look at it from a wizard's perspective of the humans and the Muggles. And so it's like, okay, yeah, different cases, but definitely I wonder if they restrict it to people who like aren't kind of from the Muggle world. But yeah.
No, very cool. All right, well, let's get into, we mentioned a few things with character development already, but let's get into that a bit more so. In this chapter, Blake, we do see a bit of an insight into Hermione, and one of the most mysterious and also her biggest storyline for this whole book really is what's going on with her timetable. And this is something that Ron is fascinated by, and I don't know, maybe we see a bit of Ron's just holistic fascination with Hermione more so than Harry. Like Harry's just not really concerned, where Ron is concerned always about all things Hermione. I don't know, maybe we see that here. But we do know that this is something that Ron will continually bring up over and over again. He's like, Hermione, what is going on with your timetable? And I'll just mention it here now because I think it fits better. This is a literary device that we see in this book throughout, is J.K. Rowling's misdirection with this timetable issue. And so what she will do continually is develop new and different ways to bring your eyes, figuratively, away from the situation of Hermione's timetable to something else that's happening that's more interesting. And here in this first chapter, what it is, it's Hermione's anger at Ron and Harry not being with her in trashing divination. And so she leaves and she storms away without answering Ron's question. And so there's so many different times that this happens, and we'll try and keep an eye out for them. But this is really brilliant because it makes the first time reader at the end of the book come back and think, there were so many clues. I should have thought about this. And I don't know what we're supposed to think is happening. I don't know if you, Blake, remember maybe in the movie even, or reading it for the first time, what you thought was going to happen. Obviously, if you had seen the movie, you would know, but I don't remember what I was thinking when it was first happening. But it's really would be interesting to hear from a first time reader what they thought was going on.
Yeah, I think you're just, it's almost like, because it does mention here that she's in, two classes at once, and, Hermione doesn't really clarify. No, I'm just doing the workload, and, I'm not actually in class. Like, it's not like that's mentioned in the books or anything, but maybe more in the movies that's like let go. Like, it's not as explicitly nailed down that it's like, no, you can't be in, four places at once, like, blah, blah, blah. Like, maybe that's dialed down in the movies a bit more than the books. I do love Harry's response, because Harry's just, he's kind of just ignorant to it all, like, or he's just
He's
not
just trying
giving
not to
his
die.
focus, because yeah, that's not his focus for the year. So it's not really any concern to him, because he doesn't care. He's not invested in figuring out this mystery, whereas Ron's just like, no, seriously, like, this little thing is bugging me. Like, what is going on? It's kind of a funny thing that Ron just gets so annoyed by, and is just like, what is happening? Like, how could she can't do that? We're in class together, or like, she's got this class. And so that's quite good there. But we do see that Hermione sides with McGonagall, right, on the views of divination, on the views of at least Professor Trelawney, and kind of yeah, McGonagall's view there. One quote that I just absolutely love that came from this chapter is, when they finish up with Trelawney, they go to Professor McGonagall's class, and they're just feeling a little bit kind of, I don't know, not interacting as much, and McGonagall doesn't get quite the reaction that she deserves of the transformation for her, which is another little drop of, anime magi, like talking about anime magi, just another little hint at that. And then You know, but this quote is just so good. It's just like the perfect summation of, I feel like, McGonagall's humor, because and also probably Hermione's humor as well, because she's the only one that laughs at this. But the quote is, you know, in response to Harry about the Grim, and he's received the Grim or whatever. And it's like, "You look in excellent health to me, Potter. So you will excuse me if I don't let you off homework today. I assure you that if you die, you need not hand it in."
So good.
I just think, as a teacher, that's like, man, if I could one day deliver that line in a class or something, maybe not that specific line. Don't want to be giving death threats to my students, but like, you know, if you could get a good kind of quip like that where, you know, you get a couple chuckles, I think that's pretty good.
Yeah, no, great. And moving from one teacher to another, this is our introduction to Sybil Trelawney. And what an introduction it is. So good. And Blake, I think it is time to ask the question. Sybil Trelawney, crazy, confused, or talented?
Yeah, I don't even know how to answer this, because I think
the answer is yes.
Yes, that's perfect. a bit of everything. Throw it all in a pot, mix it around kind of thing. Like, crazy, yes, definitely. She's very, yeah, she's kind of, I feel like, got some sort of peculiarities with her, and you know, she doesn't like descending down into the castle. She likes kind of staying up in her room, and I don't think she's the most social person. Confused, obviously, you know, it's that whole argument of, you know, divination. Is it, you know, in the wizarding world, is it actually a thing that happens frequently? And clearly not. Like, there's only a few maybe great seers out there, but deep down, she has that gift. You know, we do see that she makes those couple of prophecies and predictions and stuff. And so she has that gift, but I think it gets sort of murkied and or sort of diluted, that gift, because she's into maybe so much of these kind of gimmicky divination things. And so she has talent, but she doesn't understand, I think, the actual, like, the limit of divination, you know, whereas I feel like the Firenze, you know, and the centaurs and stuff like that, like, they're more reserved in their thinking about the, you know, what divination is and the limits that divination has. You know, I don't think Sybil's aware of that. I think, you know, she's almost like pretends to be this all-knowing person to sound impressive.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think that one of the things, Blake, that is really interesting and worth diving into for the listeners and ourselves, and maybe even the start of a bonus episode, is the question, was Sybil Trelawney ever wrong in her predictions?
Yeah.
And there's some really, really good stuff to look into with that. The answer in a short word is that she is wrong far fewer times, if any, than we might think. And so I like the sound of that for a bonus episode. We'll look at maybe all of her predictions sometime soon, because this really is her chance to shine, this book. She features heavily in Order of the Phoenix, but this is a really important Sybil book. But I totally agree with you, Blake, is that, at least in how I understand prophecy and seers in the Harry Potter world, is that it seems like the really talented ones would be aware of their own prophecies, which she is completely unaware.
No,
when she is right, she does not know. And so that really does seem to be her biggest weakness.
Yeah, the one thing about one of her prophecies that I think most curious about, and I was trying to work out whether it happened, because I know a lot of those little things that she does say come true to some extent, depending on how vague they are. But, like, I think it's to Parvati, the beware a red-haired man. And I was real confused. Like, I was like trying to think, oh, how does that one pay off? You know, like, because is it like, are they limited to this year, or is it, you know, maybe the Yule Ball? I forget if
Parvati goes. Yeah, that's what I was thinking of, the Yule Ball, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know if Parvati and Padma. Does Harry go with Padma, or does...
I think Padma goes with Ron. And so I've heard the explanation that Trelawney might have been getting the twins confused there.
Ah, I see. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So anyway, that's a good thing. That's where my mind jumped to. Was I was like, this is the only kind of interaction I feel like with the, you know, the Patel twins or whatever. And Ron, or at least, you know, a red-haired man. I thought that was quite good. But we get a little taste on the journey, or should I say the quest, to Ooh. Find Trelawney's classroom. We get to meet a lovely knight in a painting, Sir Cadogan. A little bit of a sort of humor in the chapter there with his kind of clumsiness as a quest. We must go, you know, and it's just like, okay, that's pretty classic. It's a good show of how these painted characters and these portraits can move from one painting to another. I feel like it's probably one of the biggest displays of that in the books. Aside from the fact that attack on the fat lady who then runs off to another portrait.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. I think that the other thing, Blake, that I just want to give a little shout out, as if he needs our shout out, but little shout out to Stephen Fry in this chapter. The number of voices he does is pretty unparalleled, I think, you know, from Sir Cadogan to Professor Trelawney. Hey, it's a great chapter if you want to sample some of Stephen Fry's greatest audio work.
There's quite a few in here, you know, like the characters on screen, let's say, or like, you know, kind of in at the same time is quite a lot. Like, and you just got to think, like, maybe, you know, when he was recording that, Stephen Fry was recording it, like, and he looked at the amount of, you know, I'm sure he had a list there being like, hey, these are the characters in the scene, you know, that have speaking roles. You know, if he gets to a chapter where it's just like, oh, this is just Dumbledore and Harry, he's probably thinking, whew, all right, easy chapter, let's go. But then, like, man, the ones that have like all these different voices, and, you know, and he's got to kind of find a voice for Cadogan, like Sir Cadogan, like, it's, you know, there's not, you know, there's only a small description about him, but he's got to create something up. And so, yeah, they're very, very interesting, that character there. But don't get to see much more of him.
And one of Stephen Fry's classic voices is, of course, Hagrid. He does it so well. And this is a pretty sad chapter for Hagrid. He has a lesson that starts in a pretty average way with the students feeling confused about their books, has a fantastic middle and a pretty terrible ending. So really all the range of emotions that he must have been feeling, I can only imagine, as someone who remembers my first lesson, and it did not go as poorly as a student needing to go to the hospital. So this is pretty rough for Hagrid, and he really does drown his sorrows in his liquor after the lesson
he
is over.
He goes hard. Yeah,
he does go hard. Yeah.
But it seems like giants possess this uncanny ability to shove their head in, you know, water, and for that to like almost just stop the drunkenness. You know, like, it just, I feel like, he, you know, he comes back and he's all normal after being, you know, quite all sort of intoxicated. And so I'm like, that's an interesting ability quite there. But it's a great lesson, you know, like, hippogriffs seem like some of the coolest creatures, you know, when you actually kind of think about them. They can fly and they're like horses, but they got like beautiful wings. And so it's like, you know, and maybe this is probably a nice sort of progression into world building, where we do see hippogriffs, this sort of new creature, and more explicitly Buckbeak, who does return. You know, he's actually, Buckbeak itself is kind of a way a character, because there he comes back and is actually kind of part of the plot of this book, as well as he comes back in other books as well.
Yeah, definitely. Speaking of Buckbeak, good chance to just go into a bit of world building, that this is a creature that we meet, a hippogriff. Hippogriffs, do they, I couldn't find anything on, like, do hippogriffs exist outside of Harry Potter? Like in mythology?
What? Oh. Sorry. I thought you said, sorry. I might just leave this in because of my stupidity of thinking you believed in hippogriffs in the real world.
Don't you know it?
Oh, that's so funny. I don't know, because like obviously you've got
chimeras,
which are pretty classics. Are they part of history?
Mythology.
This is a
good chance just to do some little entomology, the study and history of words. And hippogriff comes from the Greek word for hippos, meaning horse, and the word griffin. And so a hippogriff is a horse and a griffin together. This was not an original animal to J.K. Rowling, but apparently it was invented by, let me see if I can get this right, Ludovico Aristo, who was a person who lived in the 15th and 16th centuries and was a writer, a poet, and wrote the book Orlando Fiorisso, where he talked about hippogriffs.
Okay. There you go. A little bit of sort of background history into, you know, because hippogriffs aren't real, you know.
They are not but, real. A little gasp when you were thinking that.
I thought I'd have to stop this. I thought I'd have to start the podcast and actually educate you, Josh. You know, whilst you're the history teacher, I would have to come in and be like, Josh, this, you know, hippogriffs, like, you know, like a chimera or other mythological creatures are not real. But yeah, so hippogriffs are probably, you know, one of the top kind of creatures for me in the wizarding world, because I feel like they're elegant, but like also they're very practical. And I feel like if you had a good relationship, one like Hagrid has with, especially, you know, Buckbeak, I feel like, you know, they're loyal kind of creatures, you know, and helpful. And so, yeah, definitely would like a hippogriff, but probably not good around kids, you know, and by extension, the kid that is Malfoy not listening and being disrespectful. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Anything else, Josh, on hippogriffs?
No, that's it. That's okay. It. And so other than hippogriffs, which is definitely the main kind of introduction to the world at this point, we also are introduced to tea leaf reading as a subset of divination, as well as death omens via the Grimm. So Harry has already seen what he believes to be our appearances of the Grimm earlier in the book, but this kind of just confirms all that we've been suspecting about Harry seeing that large dark dog earlier, Blake.
Yeah, and it just lays more kind of, I don't know, just mystery on this, what is the Grimm, this death, you know, this death that's approaching Harry, and then who's that dog, and this sort of, you know, we're learning about animagi, and it's like coming in, but like we don't connect that yet at this stage. And then when we learn, you know, Sirius Black, he's anime, you know, it all comes together to make Sirius's Black, like his reveal of like not, first of all, being, you know, coming after Harry, but then being not guilty, like, you know, he's not, you know, this whole switch is like, it's incredible. So I do love that, you know, Harry is consumed with, I think, these thoughts. You know, he's not consumed with Hermione's timetable. He's consumed with, like, you know, the Grimm. He's seen a dog. Is it real? Yeah. And you know, is he gonna die? Sirius is Black, you know, is after him, and yeah, all that stuff. It's just like, wow.
Not much more to add there. That's great. We've already mentioned the literary device of misdirection, and again, how it features in this chapter is Hermione's anger towards Ron, taking us away from her actually answering the question about the, spoiler alert, time turner. And as well as that, we do see a bit of foreshadowing, Blake, through Professor Trelawney's predictions.
Yeah, like we mentioned before, and I think this does better find itself in maybe a bonus episode, and so we'll put that on the cards for later on. But you know, like we've said, you know, some of these predictions, these foreshadowing things, do come to pass. Like Hermione leaves, you know, the classroom. It kind of sounds like at the death or whatever. You know, someone will leave us forever.
Beyond that foreshadowing, which will gain in importance as we go on in this book, there's more foreshadowing to come. The significance of this chapter are some of the clues that are dropped along the way, clues we've already mentioned about Hermione's timetable, the new classes that they'll have, and specifically the introduction to Professor Trelawney. That's probably the main significance. At this point in the story, we're probably led to think that Professor Trelawney is not going to be that important of a character. But fast forward through to Order of the Phoenix and to Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, Professor Trelawney is going to be a mega important character, even as she is a mega terrible teacher.
Yeah, and the reason why, you know, as a terrible teacher, you think, why is Dumbledore even hiring this person? like there's a reason behind that, and that's protection. That's kind of keeping you protected.
And that really kind of gives us the only canonical insight into the kind of meta hiring that goes on at Hogwarts, is that Dumbledore is really not concerned that the kids get the best divination education. He's concerned with protecting Professor Trelawney. He's not really concerned that they get good defense against the dark arts education always. He's concerned about exposing Gilderoy Lockhart, etc. So
yes, yeah, using the what is it, the jinx or the whatever it is, the to get rid of teachers he doesn't like, and that's, you're like, come on, Dumbledore, what are you
he's,
doing?
Like, he's playing chess when everybody else is playing checkers. Let's be honest.
Oh, that's great. No, that's awesome. Well, anyway, thank you for listening. Head over to iTunes and leave a review. Your support helps keep the magic alive. Get in touch with us and ask us a question by Instagram, or send us an email at muffledoutofpodcast@gmail.com. Continue the adventure. Join us next time as we discuss the 7th chapter of Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, The Boggart in the Wardrobe.